and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the attempt by Turkey's Prime Minister to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide while still strenuously denying that the genocide took place and calling the Pope part of an evil front for using the term. David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, who headed up diplomatic efforts at reconciliation between Turkey and Armenia, known as the Turkish-Armenian Reconciliation Commission, joins us to discuss a major reversal by Turkey's top trading partner in Europe, Germany, who is now joining France, the European Parliament, and Pope Francis in calling what happened to the Armenians in 1915 genocide. Then we'll examine unexplored avenues of inquiry into the untold story leading up to 9/11 and its aftermath, in particular the role of Saudi Arabia, since 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks, joins us to discuss his push for the disclosure of the 28 pages of the congressional inquiry that remain classified, and the extraordinary coincidences involving meetings between Saudi officials and the hijackers in San Diego, and ties between the hijackers and a Saudi family in Sarasota, Florida, who abruptly left the U.S. under suspicious circumstances just before 9/11. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Centennial of the Armenian Genocide, Recognition and Reconciliation. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And it does seem that the government of Turkey is moving somewhat towards, not to in any kind of admission of guilt or you know, stopping their decades-long resistance to taking any kind of responsibility for what happened to the Armenians back in 1915. But there is something of a softening in tone from the Prime Minister, who said that the Ottoman Armenians would be commemorated at a religious ceremony in the Armenian Patriarchate in Istanbul on April the 24th and on the 100th anniversary, in what the Turkish Prime Minister described as an historic and humane duty for Turkey. But that is, of course, very much short of any admission of culpability.
So Prime Minister Davutoğlu only announced that ceremony after he greeted Pope Francis's claim that the Armenian Genocide was the first of the 20th century by saying that Francis had joined a, quote, evil front. President Erdogan literally warned Pope Francis about his statement and threatened him not to make similar mistakes in the future. So these conciliatory remarks coming from Davutoğlu now are really just an effort to recover lost ground for mistakes that Turkish officials have made not only this week but over recent years as they continue their official campaign of denial.
And Erdogan's statements are pretty extraordinary, aren't they? I mean, he's known for making some fairly outrageous remarks, but that, to take on the Pope in that way, is pretty strange, isn't it?
It's an insult to the Pope. It's an insult to Armenians and to all of those who work to prevent genocide. What we've seen in the past week is the Pope making a statement recognizing the Armenian genocide, the European Parliament issuing a resolution. Chancellor Angela Merkel also used the genocide term. The Austrian government similarly has used the genocide word. So there is a worldwide mobilization around the centennial of the Armenian genocide to recognize the facts as we know them to be the genocide of the Armenian people.
Well, particularly the case of Chancellor Angela Merkel, the German government has had a pretty steadfast refusal to use the term genocide. And of course, Germany is Turkey's top trading partner in the European Union and home to millions of Turks who live and work in Germany. That's pretty significant, isn't it?
It is very significant, and I salute Chancellor Merkel for having the courage to speak the truth. She should be a standard for other world leaders, including President Obama, who's still debating whether or not in his April 24th Remembrance Day statement, he'll use the term genocide.
Well, the Germans, of course, were involved in Turkey in World War I. They were allies, and the massacre took place in 1915. And, of course, on the following day, April the 25th, is the day that Australia and New Zealand have their commemoration of the landing at Gallipoli. That's an important milestone in Australia, and it's an important holiday of remembrance. And the Turkish government tried to move the remembrance of the 100th anniversary of Gallipoli forward one day to sort of take the heat off the Armenian 100th anniversary. That doesn't appear to have worked.
So I'm not familiar with the details. To my understanding, they have rescheduled the Gallipoli commemoration to the 24th. This is a cynical effort to distract the international community from the Armenian genocide centennial. There will be many heads of state and senior delegations in Yerevan on April 24. So this effort to reschedule the Gallipoli anniversary has been seen for what it is, a cynical effort to distract the international community from what is the real commemoration, the murder of 1.5 million Armenians.
And again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Centennial of the Armenian Genocide, Recognition and Reconciliation. So just back to Germany, David Phillips. Germans, of course, were allies in World War I with the Turks. And my understanding is that the German military high command in Turkey at the time of the Armenian massacre documented what was happening. And they were even quite appalled by what was happening. So Germany must have in its records, as I believe the United States has in its State Department records, consular officials and their first-hand accounts of what happened in terms of this murder of 1.5 million Armenians. So what's going to be done in terms of the historical record, given this decades-long denial on the part of Turkey that it actually happened, when there's contemporaneous reports both from the United States and from Germany that it happened?
So there is a century of scholarship, eyewitness accounts at the time, and the testimony of trials in Turkey at the end of the First World War, all attesting to the Armenian genocide. It's not a question of whether the events meet the definition of genocide. That's now a generally agreed fact. It's whether or not Turkish civil society can have a real debate about its role. Like Germany did after the Second World War, there needs to be an admission of responsibility in order to catalyze a process of reconciliation. Until Turkey accepts the responsibility of its actions in committing the Armenian genocide, it's not going to become a truly normal country, fully integrated into the West and into its region. That's why this centennial is such an important milestone. It's an opportunity for Turks to engage with Armenians and with one another in an honest discourse about what happened.
And David Phillips, you've been involved in Turkish and Armenian issues since 1998, and you headed up a diplomatic effort to bring about truth and reconciliation between Turkey and Armenia. What happened to that commission that you headed, the Turkish-Armenian Reconciliation Commission, otherwise known as TARC?
So the TARC existed for several years, from 2001 to 2004. It was never envisioned to work in perpetuity. At the end of its activities, TARC issued a set of recommendations about confidence-building measures between Turks and Armenians, encouraging governments to issue statements in support of civil society contact and cooperation, and calling on the governments to normalize relations. In 2007, with the help of Swiss mediation, Turkey and Armenia did start a discrete process that resulted in the Turkey-Armenia protocols on normalization of relations. The Swiss mediator, Michael Ambuhl, did a superb job. He was with us last week at Columbia. Those agreements represent a way forward, but they were never ratified by the Turkish parliament. They still are on the table. They still represent an opportunity for progress. But until they are implemented and until there is recognition by the Turkish government and Turkish society of what happened, it's going to be extremely difficult for there to be any real reconciliation progress.
Well, isn't one of the problems Erdogan himself? Because under Erdogan, Turkey's become a very authoritarian state. We saw the demonstrations in Taksim Square about Gezi Park and the extent to which this piece of greenery in it was about to be bulldozed for development. And of course, development is a part of the very party that Erdogan's government has. I mean, that's their acronym. So give us a sense of do you think things would be, you would have thought that in a rational and reasonable world that the Turkish governments would take this opportunity on the 100th anniversary of the Armenian genocide to basically get out from under this mess and basically, you know, do what's necessary to end this agony. But instead, they've chosen to double down. And I suspect a lot of that's to do with the fact that Erdogan himself is a very combative person, isn't he?
We need to be steely-eyed in looking at Turkey. And we need to see Turkey for how it is, not how it used to be or how we want it to be. Turkey today is anti-democratic, anti-Western, starting with the crackdown of environmental protesters in Gezi Park in June of 2013. There were demonstrations of police brutality against peaceful protesters in 60 cities. Article 301 of the Penal Code is used to crack down on freedom of expression. Article 8 of the Anti-Terror Act used to limit freedom of association. Erdogan has targeted the Gulen movement, Fethullah Gulen, and looked to remove police officers and judges from their posts. There is a pattern of authoritarianism in Turkey, which is of serious concern. Turkey has always been a valued member of NATO, but we need to recognize that NATO is much more than a security alliance. It's a coalition of countries that share values. And if NATO were being established today, based on Turkey's current authoritarianism, it would not be suitable as a NATO member. It's certainly not suitable for EU membership. That's part of the reason why Turkey is alienated from the West. It's also alienated from countries in the Middle East because of its role in aiding and abetting and providing logistical support to the Islamic State, fighters traveling through Turkey from Urfa into Raqqa in Syria. So there's a very sordid record of Turkey over the past couple of years under President Erdogan.
But Erdogan himself is popular, isn't he? I mean, he got overwhelmingly re-elected.
He won the presidential election with a majority on the first round. Turkey will have national elections on the 7th of June. It remains to be seen whether or not he will have enough votes in the parliament to establish an executive presidency. He's become popular because he represents the Turks' strength and charisma. Turkey's economy has been rehabilitated. The Anatolian heartland, where there are many supporters of the AK party of President Erdogan, have benefited materially. They've returned those benefits to the AKP. Without doubt, Erdogan has popular support, but it's shallow support, and Turkey's economy has been stimulated and is on a bubble, and when that bursts, we may see a serious depreciation in popular support for Erdogan and his policies.
Well, there's no question that he has an outsized ego and this extraordinary palace that he built for himself, over, what, $100 million? It seems to indicate that oversized, out-of-control ego. Is there any backlash in Turkey? I mean, there's a long history, my understanding, of Turkish engagement with Europe and the fact that, for example, there's so many in the Turkish diaspora in Germany. My understanding is that he's moving rapidly away from European values. Turkey had very good relations with Israel. My understanding is that Erdogan is actually an anti-Semite. I mean, how much is he out of step with whatever, you know, we could call traditional Turkish values, or are we seeing a new face of Turkey? I'm trying to get a sense of whether this could be reversed in this election or whether he represents, unfortunately, the future of Turkey.
The Turkish people have a very noble self-image. And to Turks, hospitality is a very endearing quality. For Turks to confront their past and recognize what their ancestors did to the Armenians is a very big challenge. Erdogan is capitalizing on what is known as the Sevres syndrome, efforts by great powers so perceived to diminish and take territory from Turkey as a way of consolidating the base of his support. I still believe, and I have many Turkish friends, that they are a noble people who want to have an honest reckoning with the past. Until that happens, until there's a political environment so that Turks can engage in a real discourse with themselves and with their neighbors, including Armenians, about what happened, Turks and Turkey will never really become a normal country. That's why Erdogan stands in the way of progress. The Turks deserve better. They'll have an opportunity on June 7th to express their views at the ballot box. The Kurds of Turkey will play a critical role. They've been promised a peace process. That's never been delivered. If the Kurdish party surpasses the 10% barrier and is seated in parliament, then they become crucial deal makers for any constitutional reform in Turkey. That's where we might see some change in Erdogan's approach when he has to accommodate different stakeholders.
Well, could there be an anti-Erdogan coalition? I mean, he's gone after the military. He's gone after the secular state, the pro-European Turks, by imposing Islamism, I guess, for the want of a better description. And he's also going after the Gulen movement. So could you form an anti-Erdogan coalition?
So when you look at all those constituencies, they oppose what Erdogan is doing. They come from different backgrounds ideologically. They haven't really coalesced into an opposition to the AKP. But when it comes to forming a new government, it's a parliamentary system. There'll be jockeying for positions and power, and these groups will have a chance to express their views and to align with one another. But of course, that all depends on how the votes are counted, and if they're counted freely and fairly. I believe that Turks do want to move from this position of being an ostracized nation and more fully integrate into the West, restore their good relations with Washington. That can't happen unless Erdogan changes his approach or there is a more formidable opposition that brings Turkey to the table with a different posture and position. Let's see what happens with the election. You know, Erdogan is not Turkey. Turkey is made up of Turkish citizens, and they come from many different sectarian and ethnic groups. So there's still hope for the country to coalesce around a more modern vision than Erdogan has offered.
And just in closing, what kind of a percentage are the ultranationalists?
So there are two. First, let's recognize that all parties in Turkey are nationalistic. The ultranationalists, which is the MHP, maybe will have 15% of the vote. The CHP, which is also a nationalist party, may end up with 20%. If you put those nationalist parties, opposition parties, together with the Kurds, who could end up with 10 or 12%, and a few others, then you get close to the 50% threshold. A parliamentary system is difficult to manage. You know, Erdogan has shown a formidable ability to marshal support, not only in the ballot box, but in the parliament. We have to see how Turks mobilize in opposition and whether they have the character and unity to stand for more modern values, which would integrate Turkey into the EU and restore its good relations with Washington.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Centennial of the Armenian Genocide, Recognition and Reconciliation. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back examining the unexplored avenues of inquiry into the untold story leading up to 9/11 with the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He's the author of the suspense novel Keys to the Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Bob Graham.
Thank you very much, Ian, for the invitation to return.
And, Senator, the Saudis have been quite assertive now in Yemen, and it looks as though the young son of the king, the new king, who has very little experience outside of his country, he wasn't educated abroad, and they may be actually getting themselves into a quagmire in Yemen. But in general, when I talk to Middle East specialists, they always point out at the end of the day that the underlying religious ideology of so much of the problems that are besetting us in the world, whether it's Al-Qaeda, the so-called Islamic State, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, and so on, has its roots in Saudi Wahhabism. And I'm astounded at what seems to be a kind of collective blindness on our part as to the role of Saudi Arabia in radicalizing one of the world's great religions.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I would go further to say that I believe the Saudis have gotten a signal from our passivity, our continued cover-up of its activities in 9/11, that it is immune from any sanction. If a country could be a co-conspirator in an event as horrific as 9/11 and receive no rebuke, what else could they do? And I think the what else could they do is what they are doing. They are continuing to fund madrasas with extremely negative education relative to other religions and peoples. They are funding imams in mosques who preach a form of violence and intolerance. Those are the breeding grounds for this and future generation of terrorists that will populate organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And yet we, the United States, has continued to protect the Saudis by the refusal to release information which is in our possession that would indicate the degree to which Saudi Arabia was involved in 9/11. I think it's an absolute outrage.
Well, not only is this information unavailable, and there are certainly a lot of suspicions about the Saudi role, which we certainly will get into in a moment, but after 9/11, the only planes flying, everything was grounded except for planes ferrying Saudi Arabians out of the United States.
Within hours of 9/11, the ambassador from Saudi Arabia to the United States, Prince Bandar, concerned that the fact that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals, that there would be a backlash against Saudis living in the United States. He went to the White House, persuaded President Bush to authorize a flight which happened to emanate from Lexington, Kentucky, back to Saudi Arabia, filled with somewhere between 145 and 160 prominent Saudis, including members of bin Laden's family.
So in terms of the inquiry that you've been urging for some time, and obviously being chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time of 9/11, and then being the head of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the terrorist attacks, it's given you a lot of information, but you're trying to pry loose from some of the classified information, in particularly the 28 pages of the Congressional Inquiry. So explain to us what the resistance is that you're getting.
The resistance is particularly from agencies like the FBI, just an immediate no to request for information. Then they say, if you want this information, file a Freedom of Information Act request, which I have found to be a very prolonged, difficult task. And at every stage of the way, the FBI has fought the Freedom of Information request in a case that emanated from a suspicious situation in Sarasota, Florida. The FBI's initial response to the what's referred to as FOIA, Freedom of Information, was that there were no documents about a Saudi connection to hijackers in Sarasota. The court was in disbelief about that statement, kept pressing them, and finally the FBI released to the judge, they're still classified, but they're in his possession, 80,000 pages of documents about their investigation in Sarasota. I've used the term aggressive deception. I don't think that's an inappropriate or over-the-top phrase to use for an agency that started out saying we have no documents and ends up producing 80,000.
And again, I'm speaking with Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He's the author of the suspense novel Keys to the Kingdom. Now, specifically, the Sarasota, Florida inquiry involves a Saudi family that had multiple contacts with the hijackers training nearby, and this family fled before the 9/11 attacks. And what do we know that's in the public domain about them?
Not much, because, again, it's assumedly all in these 80,000 pages of documents that the FBI collected or produced on the subject. What we do know is that the family had lived in Sarasota for approximately 6 years, and it was a three-generational family, grandparents, parents, and children, that the grandfather had a reputation of being very close to the royal family and to other influential people in Sarasota. We also know that three of the hijackers did their initial flight training at schools in the Sarasota area, and that there was evidence that those three hijackers had spent considerable time at the home of this prominent Saudi family. There were telephone records, photographs of license plates of cars entering the front gate that led to the house. And then what is very suspicious is that less than 2 weeks before 9/11, the family left Sarasota under what have been described as urgent conditions. There was a new car in front of the house, food on the table, dirty clothes in the washer, and they returned quickly to Saudi Arabia. The suspicion is that somebody tipped them off that there was an event about to happen which would make it uncomfortable for them to be in the United States and better off if they were back in Saudi Arabia, and they were.
Well, of course, the 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, who is in federal prison here in the United States, he recently disclosed in a letter that prominent members of the Saudi Arabia's royal family were major donors to the terrorist network that he belonged to. And of course, we also know in the case of Zacharias Moussaoui, the FBI agent Colleen Rowley, who was looking into him, was frustrated by FBI headquarters. So that may lead to perhaps in part the explanation for why the FBI are reluctant to, you know, pry loose all of these unexplored threads that are still dangling out there.
Well, there's always the possibility that when the same agency has responsibility to carry out a mission, in this case, investigate the activities of the hijackers prior to 9/11, and particularly their relationships with persons who might have been supporting them while they were preparing for 9/11. And then that same agency has the opportunity to classify and keep the reports of those activities away from the public. That a reason that they're doing it is concern that their inquiry would be considered incompetent. In fact, one of the ironies of Sarasota now is some 13 years after the event, as more information has trickled out, including one that was released by the FBI, heavily redacted, but a document which was one of the investigative reports by the special FBI agent in charge, in which he wrote that there were many connections between the Saudi family and the hijackers. The FBI is now saying that the FBI agent who wrote that was incompetent and not skilled in the English language, and have distanced themselves from what their own person selected to lead an investigation into an important element of 9/11 wrote contemporaneously with the investigation. That raises another set of questions.
And, of course, I believe the FBI contacted you, very senior people contacted you and more or less told you to back off this inquiry, that you're wasting your time. Is that true?
That's true. The Sarasota issue came to light as a result of the work of a two journalists, Anthony Summers and Dan Christensen. Anthony was writing a book which became The 11th Day, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for 2011. Dan Christensen is an investigative journalist with a blog called The Florida Bulldog. And the two of them, mainly through interviews with people who had been involved in the investigations that took place at the home of the Saudi family, became very suspicious of this. Knowing of my interest, they told me about this, and I started some inquiries with the FBI. This was in the September period of 2011, and then just before Thanksgiving, I was called to the office of the FBI at Dulles Airport and basically told to forget about it, that it was cold and elusive leads, and that I could spend my time doing better things than trying to find out what happened in Sarasota. Again, an effort to try to shut down legitimate questions by Americans as to what their agencies have done in their name to understand what really happened on that horrific day of September 11th, 2001.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll come back and continue the conversation with Senator Bob Graham. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He is the author of the suspense novel Keys to the Kingdom. Well, let's focus on nearby here where I'm speaking to you from. You're obviously in Florida, former senator representing Florida, Bob Graham, and I'm in Los Angeles and not far from here in San Diego. There were two hijackers. They apparently were tracked by the CIA in Malaysia. I think Malaysian intelligence were monitoring them. The CIA lost them at the airport in Bangkok. They show up in San Diego. It turns out that they're being funded by the wife of the Saudi ambassador. They also apparently run into by pure chance, a Saudi official in a restaurant in San Diego, which is extraordinary coincidence. So what have you uncovered in that regard? I mean, there's so many coincidences in that regard and connections to the Saudi ambassador's wife.
That is a very tangled story in San Diego. The key character is a man named Omar Bayoumi. Bayoumi had been living in San Diego for two or three years before 2000. His assignment was to monitor Saudi students to determine if any of them might be fulminating actions that would be considered threatening to the kingdom. The royal family became very concerned about what had happened in Iran, where a youth-led revolution had overthrown the Shah, and so they wanted to be sure that their young people were not fulminating any such plots. Well, anyway, this man Bayoumi was apparently given the assignment of also caring for the first two of the eventual 19 hijackers who came into the United States through Los Angeles. Shortly after they arrived there, Bayoumi went to the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles and had an hour-long meeting with a man who was in charge of the consulate's cultural and religious affairs, and who 2 years later was deported from the United States because of alleged terrorist connections. Well, after that meeting between Bayoumi and the now deported consulate official, he went to a restaurant in your city of Los Angeles and ended up sitting next to the two hijackers. They struck up a conversation. He encouraged them to move to San Diego, which they did, and that he would give them assistance if they came to San Diego, which he also did. And that started a whole ring of relationships and activities, which maybe at its height ended up that these two hijackers became the landlord of a man who, at the same time as he was renting out rooms in his house, was a paid agent of the FBI to monitor Saudi students to determine if they were plotting any activities against the United States. So you had the irony that two future hijackers were living in the home of a man who was supposed to be watching young people for their dangerous activities that might be threatening to the United States.
Well, but there was also, wasn't there in this particular case, that the FBI was not informed by the CIA that they knew about these two? So I'm a little puzzled by that. I understand, in fact, the person at the CIA who didn't inform the FBI about the two hijackers in San Diego was the same person that became the character that movie, Zero Dark Thirty, was written about. But why then, if you have the landlord, an FBI informant, why was the FBI unaware that these hijackers were in San Diego?
Well, first, you're right. The CIA had monitored primarily by outsourcing the task to the Malaysian Intelligence Agency, a meeting that took place in Kuala Lumpur in early January 2000 that is frequently referred to as the Summit of Terrorists, where what became the bombing of the USS Cole and the initial planning for 9/11 took place. The CIA had significant information about that meeting, although they didn't have a listening device in the room, which they should have had. But they took lots of pictures, and they got a picture of one of the future hijackers' passport and photographed that. But for reasons not ever fully explained, the CIA did not relay that information either to the FBI or to the Border Control, which might have used it when the two hijackers came through LAX just a couple of weeks later. So the relationship between our domestic intelligence agency, the FBI, and our foreign intelligence agency, the CIA, did not service very well in that instance.
And I also recall, Senator Graham, that there was a report shortly after 9/11, when the Saudis, after the Saudis had flown out of the United States, that a senior Saudi official, perhaps somebody from the royal family, showed up dead in the desert, and there was some speculation that that person knew something about 9/11. Does that ever cross your radar?
That is an instance which I am not familiar.
I see. So, and I recall, you know, one of the times we spoke before, that you told me that on the morning of 9/11, you were actually having breakfast with the head of the Pakistani military intelligence, the ISI.
With the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Porter Goss, and Senator John Kyle, the three of us had visited in August of 2001 several places that the CIA had indicated they thought might be important in a terrorist network. And one of those places was Pakistan, where we were hosted by the head of the Pakistani intelligence, which is called the ISI, a man named General Ahmed. He was very gracious, very forthcoming with information. We invited him to join us when he next came to Washington, and it happened that that next time was September the 11th. We were having breakfast with him at the House Intelligence Conference Room in the Capitol when we received the notifications about the attacks on New York and the Pentagon.
Well, of course, the fact that bin Laden was in Saudi Arabia, that he was in effect a serial killer, having blown up the embassies in Africa, and the Clinton administration and the CIA officer Mike Scheuer were certainly targeting him, and of course Scheuer argues that they could have neutralized him on a couple of occasions and didn't. So in the conversations with the head of the ISI, there must have been some reference to the fact that bin Laden was right next door in Afghanistan, and we know that the ISI has a pretty sophisticated understanding of what goes on in Afghanistan.
Yes, and that was why we were particularly interested in continuing the conversation that had started in Islamabad. The ISI had been given the responsibility to be the principal conduit between the government of Pakistan and the Taliban, which in turn was providing cover for Al-Qaeda. And so he was a man rich with information. We started the conversation with a question about what were the motivations of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And he was in the midst of a lengthy discussion of what their sense of mission was when we started getting these messages. And unfortunately, for many reasons, but for this one, we never continued the conversation to the point of the kinds of questions that we think he could have given us some information on that related to the operational relationships, particularly between Pakistan, the Taliban, and then the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
But prior to the 9/11, of course, President Clinton had retaliated against bin Laden and sent cruise missiles into a Al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan. And my understanding is that bin Laden was tipped off and had left before the cruise missiles arrived. The suspicion is that he was tipped off because the U.S. did inform the Pakistanis that these missiles would be flying across their territory, obviously with tensions between these two nuclear-armed states, India and Pakistan. It was, I imagine, necessary to inform the Pakistanis that cruise missiles would be crossing their territory. Is that your understanding?
Yes. I don't know from personal knowledge the degree to which the Pakistanis were were involved in the alleged tip-off of bin Laden. Apparently, there was a meeting being held at a hunting lodge in the desert of Afghanistan, and that's where they thought bin Laden was located, and that's where the missiles were fired. Whether bin Laden was actually there, and if he was not there, had he been tipped off, and was he tipped off by the Pakistan, I think those are unsubstantiated.
And what about Saudi intelligence efforts to make a deal with Mullah Omar to give up bin Laden? Have you looked into that at all, whether that went anywhere?
Well, obviously it didn't result in bin Laden being captured. Bin Laden, immediately after September the 11th, moved up into the mountains that separate Afghanistan and Pakistan, and his presence was well authenticated. There was an effort to put a circle of security around the valley in which he was located. The United States had refused to commit sufficient troops to do that on our own, and so we had asked the Pakistanis to provide some of that security. Whether that was responsible for allowing bin Laden to escape from his mountain cave is another unanswered question, but that was probably the closest that we had gotten to capturing bin Laden until his death a decade or more later.
Well, Senator Graham, just in the last couple of minutes, obviously there's been a lot of speculation about what happened before and who was responsible for 9/11, and it's led to a kind of cottage industry of conspiracies about the idea that somehow the Twin Towers in New York were laden with explosives, which is a highly fanciful notion, because if they were able to plant explosives in the World Trade Center, then they wouldn't even need the airplanes. So none of these conspiracy theories make any sense. But the point I'm making here is that they are blossoming in the vacuum of information. And my sense is that one of the reasons why the full story of 9/11 hasn't been told is that those responsible for American security at the time, being the president and the vice president and his cabinet, really did drop the ball. They ignored all the warnings from the Clinton administration, etc. So is that a part of the problem, in effect, that those in charge at the time perhaps could be found guilty of negligence in the sense that they placed the entire United States in danger by ignoring repeated warnings? And curiously, to my mind, the conspiracy theorists actually are letting the administration or the Bush administration off the hook. And my feeling is that there was never a full airing of the extent to which there was prior warning and there was reckless endangerment of the United States.
Well, there are many possible answers to the question, why did the Bush administration classify and withhold from the public so much of the basic information as to what happened? You've given one of those, and that is that their own role in the lead-up to 9/11 might be very unsavory. Also, the relationship of the United States and Saudi Arabia, which had gone back to World War II, when essentially the United States agreed that it would provide military security for Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia committed to provide the United States a reliable source of petroleum. There also is the close family relationship between the House of Saud and the Bush family. All those are possible answers. What to me is more difficult to understand is why, with the Obama administration, this same same level of classification and withholding has continued. And I would hope that before President Obama leaves, and sooner than later, that there is a reversal of the current policy, and not only the 28 pages, but so much other material that would shed light on the kinds of questions that you've been asking would be made available.
Well, just in closing, Senator Graham, I take it you're going to keep slogging away here at trying to pry loose all of this, these gaps in the record of what happened prior to 9/11 and after 9/11.
Yes, I think first it's a matter of the truth. The American people in a free democracy deserve to know what their government has done in their name, unless there is a overwhelmingly compelling reason to do otherwise. Second is justice. There are thousands of husbands, wives, sons, daughters of the victims of 9/11 who've been trying to get justice in our federal court system and have largely been denied it because Saudi Arabia has been able to effectively raise the doctrine of sovereign immunity. The king can do no wrong, so you can't sue the king. If the information which I strongly suspect is available were to be public, I think it would significantly change the equation of those injured Americans in their suit against Saudi Arabia. And then finally, I believe that the withholding has emboldened Saudi Arabia to continue its support through religious, economic, and military means of extremist organizations and the pipeline that produces future generations of persons who will engage in terrorist violence. All those things are the poison fruit that has come from our withholding of information on the unanswered questions of 9/11.
Well, Senator Graham, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Senator Bob Graham, who's the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He's the author of the suspense novel Keys to the Kingdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.